Good morning, everyone. I think I know most of you, but for anyone who doesn't, my name's Ange. I'm going to be reading from the book of Exodus today. So we're starting in chapter 11, verse 1, and we're going into chapter 12, verse 36. So if you can find that in your Bibles, there are copies of Bibles over there if you don't have one with you today. Now the Lord had said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. And when he does, he will drive you out completely. Tell the people that men and women alike are to ask their neighbours for articles of silver and gold. The Lord made the Egyptians favourably disposed toward the people, and Moses himself was highly regarded in Egypt by Pharaoh's officials and by the people. So Moses said, this is what the Lord says, about midnight I will go throughout Egypt. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die, from the firstborn son of Pharaoh, who sits on the throne, to the firstborn son of the female slave who is at her handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle as well. There will be loud wailing throughout Egypt, worse than there has ever been or ever will be again. But among the Israelites, not a dog will bark at any person or animal. Then you will know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. All these officials of yours will come to me, bowing down before me and saying, go, you and all the people who follow you. After that, I will leave. Then Moses, hot with anger, left Pharaoh. The Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh will refuse to listen to you so that my wonders may be multiplied in Egypt. Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let the Israelites go out of his country. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, this month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbour, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or boiled in water, but roasted over a fire with the head, legs, and internal organs. Do not leave any of it till morning. If some is still left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. This is a day you are to commemorate. For the generations to come, you shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. For 7 days, you are to eat bread made without yeast. On the first day, remove the yeast from your houses, for whoever eats anything with yeast in it from the first day through to the seventh must be cut off from Israel. On the first day, hold a sacred assembly and another one on the seventh day. Do no work at all on these days, except to prepare food for everyone to eat. That is all you may do. Celebrate the festival of unleavened bread, because it was on this very day that I brought your divisions out of Egypt. Celebrate this day as a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. In the first month, you are to eat bread made without yeast from the evening of the 14th day until the evening of the 21st day. For 7 days, no yeast is to be found in your houses, and anyone, whether foreigner or native-born, who eats anything with yeast in it must be cut off from the community of Israel. Eat nothing made with yeast. Wherever you live, you must eat unleavened bread. Then Moses summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go at once and select the animals for your families and slaughter the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it into the blood in the basin and put some of the blood on the top and on both sides of the door frame. None of you shall go out the door of your house until morning. When the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the tops and sides of the door frame and will pass over that doorway, and he will not permit the destroyer to enter your houses and strike you down. Obey these instructions as a lasting ordinance for you and your descendants. When you enter the land that the Lord will give you as he promised, observe this ceremony. And when your children ask you, 'What does this ceremony mean to you?' then tell them, 'It is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians.' Then the people bowed down and worshipped. The Israelites did just what the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeons and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was a loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. During the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, 'Up, leave my people, you and the Israelites. Go worship the Lord as you have requested. Take your flocks and herds as you have said and go, and also bless me.' The Egyptians urged the people to hurry and leave the country, 'For otherwise,' they said, 'we will all die.' So the people took their dough before the yeast was added and carried it on their shoulders in kneading troughs wrapped in clothing. The Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and for clothing. The Lord made the Egyptians favorably disposed toward the people, and they gave them what they asked for, so they plundered the Egyptians."
Well, hey, good morning, everyone. My name's Matt. I'm one of the pastors here at Christ Central. Good to be with you this morning as we do tackle this amazing and epic part of the story of the Exodus, the Passover. It is a famous moment. It's a moment that really defines his people, God's people in the Old Testament. A moment so extraordinary that they would celebrate and remember it through the years. Now, I wonder how many big world-changing events like that you can remember. For me, I remember I was in year 12. I had a chemistry exam that morning, and what had happened, 9/11 had just happened. And trying to sit a year 12 chemistry exam on the day that 9/11 was all unfolding and all the chaos and everything that was going on, knowing that the world had changed, was just something else. I actually was thinking the other day about just imagine for a moment, what are you going to tell your children or your grandchildren about the year that was 2020, the year of the coronavirus? I wonder what sort of stories you might tell, what kind of things might you remember going forward about how the world changed on that year. Now, we'll be covering this event known as the Passover, an event still celebrated by Jews thousands of years later, celebrating the day that God freed Israel from Egypt. It's called the Passover because God passed over his judgment on Israel and instead brought judgment upon Egypt. Now, I would say that actually this is the defining moment of the Old Testament, okay, the defining moment of the Old Testament, a moment that they will look back to all the way through the Old Testament. But not only that, it's actually the defining moment of the Old Testament that also explains the defining moment of the New Testament as well. So massively significant moment that we're going to be learning about. And, we saw last week there was the epic story of the plagues that Moses and Aaron unleashed upon Pharaoh, upon Egypt. But at the end of it, Pharaoh was resolute. He was not giving in. He was not letting the people go. Now I kind of wonder what Moses was thinking at that time. I mean, God, come on, we've tried 9 different ways already and Pharaoh is still saying no. This Pharaoh who thinks of himself as a God, and there he is challenging, standing up to God, the God. Now, I think Moses is himself getting bolder and bolder, but still after 9 plagues, the people are still in slavery. Then here in chapter 11, God announces one final plague, but this time he says, Pharaoh will let the people go. Now, if you've got your Bibles, open up, come back with me to chapter 11, chapter 11, verse 1. We'll retrace some of the steps of the story this morning. And chapter 11, verse 1 says this: Now the Lord had said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. And when he does, he will drive you out completely. Okay, so Moses goes and takes that word up to Pharaoh. So Moses said, verse 4, this is what the Lord says. About midnight, I will go throughout Egypt. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die, from the firstborn son of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn son of the female slave who is at her right, at her handmill, and the firstborn of the cattle as well. There will be loud wailing throughout Egypt, worse than there has ever been or ever will be again. But among the Israelites, not a dog will bark at any person or animal. So Moses announces something terrifying is going to happen. Now, if you're familiar with this part of the Bible, don't let your familiarity get in the way of you realizing just how shocking and horrifying this particular plague is. Okay, I mean, all the plagues have been kind of terrifying in their own way, but this is kind of on a whole nother level, isn't it? I mean, let's not sugarcoat what's going to happen here. The death of thousands of firstborn children. God himself predicts that there'll be loud wailing throughout Egypt, the sort of pain and distress that won't be forgotten easily. I mean, it's just that reminder that you can't domesticate God. If you are under God's judgment, that is a fearful and terrifying thing. Now, I remember the sheer terror, actually, that would be similar to this somewhat, but it's this funny moment that when you're a first-time parent and your baby, your newborn baby just sleeps through the night for the first time. Now, you would think, oh, yes, first time in a long time, an uninterrupted night of sleep. But now, what does a first-time parent think? Oh, no, my baby has died. Right? That's the kind of thing that goes through your mind because they get up every 3 hours or whatever it is and they haven't woken up now for 6 hours or 8 hours or whatever it is. Now your first thought, then I remember the sheer terror that grips your heart when you think that maybe something terrible has happened to my kid. Now I think that's the kind of terror that must have been going throughout Egypt. I mean, it's so terrifying that I think part of us might even be kind of questioning, I mean, God, is this necessary? Could you not have found another way? And are not these Egyptian babies innocent? Well, I think actually if we look a bit closer, this plague, I mean, I think we often do think of it as the plague upon these innocent infants, but actually there's a symbolism going on here. Now, Mike did a really good job last week of explaining how actually all of the plagues have some sort of symbolic aspect, that God is targeting a particular aspect of Egyptian culture or religion. You know, the Nile's not just a long river, but actually is a symbolic of this life-giving nature, of this God-like thing that the Egyptians bestowed upon the Nile. Well, the firstborn in Egypt also symbolizes something more. Now, firstborn could be any age, so not necessarily all little babies. The firstborn, though, was the heir of the household, right? The heir of the household had all absolute power within the family unit. They were the ones being groomed to be the next heads of the household. Now, who is a firstborn male here? Who's a firstborn male here? Yeah? Okay, we've got a few. Okay, all right. Now, everyone else, guess what? That means you would have been serving these guys, right? They would have been treated like kings, like gods, everyone else kind of came second place to them. See, there was immense power that was contained within that birthright. You know, in other words, when God says he's going to strike at the firstborn, he is striking at the symbol of power and strength within the Egyptian civilization, that actually these firstborns would rise up to become the leaders. These are the ones who would propagate Egyptian culture going into the future, and that's the point that God's going to strike them. Now, so the death of the firstborn, this moment where God's going to triumph over Egypt, over Egyptian culture. But it's not only that, but also it's the triumph of God's firstborn over Egypt's firstborn. So actually back at the start, back in chapter 4, God actually decreed that this was going to happen. It'll come up behind me. This is Moses saying to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says. Israel is my firstborn son, and I told you, let my son go so he may worship me. But you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son. Now, do you see? This is the judgment upon Egypt for the past 430 years of slavery. For Pharaoh's stubbornness in keeping God's people enslaved, that over centuries now, Egypt has profited off the free labor of 1 million Israelite slaves. This is the oppression of God's own firstborn son. See, I think this is a horrifying moment. Let's not sugarcoat. That's a horrifying moment in the Bible, and yet there's a sense in which this is the justice that is being brought. This is Egypt's due. This isn't just a harsh punishment of a vindictive God, but one who is righteously bringing judgment upon a nation that has defied him and inflicted centuries of slavery and oppression on his people. See, anyone who stands against God does so at their peril. God says he himself is going to move through Egypt. And when a holy and just God moves through your midst, sin and sinners will simply melt in his presence. But here's the problem. The problem is that it's not just Egypt that is under threat right now. Israel is actually also under threat. And a lot of the next chapter, in chapter 12, is actually explaining that God himself has to make provisions to protect his own people from his own judgment and holiness. So come with me to chapter 12, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, "This month is for you to be the first month, first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. The animals you choose must be a year old male without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats." All right, so what's going to happen? So the Israelite families are going to take this one-year-old lamb, this cute little thing. It's going to be healthy, spotless. Lamb's going to actually move in with the family for 4 days, okay? Going to be a part of the family for 4 days. Now, I don't know what you do with a pet lamb, whether you play fetch with it or you feed it the kind of leftovers at the end of dinner, or what you do with a little lamb, but this lamb would actually become part of the family, would actually live amongst them, and so help the family actually identify with this lamb. But then what's going to happen next is meant to shock the family, meant to shock everyone involved. Verse 6. "Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast." Okay, so 1 year-old lamb, part of your household, then gets slaughtered and eaten, blood smeared across the doorposts. Now, why? What's the striking ritual? Now, I think often with all rituals, there's a strong symbolism going at play. It's supposed to be this visceral thing, right? This little lamb that was running around your feet at one point, that you brush your hand over and patted, that you felt this lamb, the touch of the lamb, the sight of the blood as it smeared across the doorposts, the smell of its roasted meat, and the taste. It's the kind of ritual that actually the kids are supposed to be a part of and to ask questions about. I mean, Ma, Pa, why did we have to kill the lamb? And the parents would then take the opportunity to go ahead and explain it. And they'd explain these three things. They would explain, it reminds them of their sin, their substitute, and their salvation. So let me explain those three things. Their sin, their substitute, and their salvation. The first one's their sin. You see, when God brings judgment into the land of Egypt, it results in death. Because the thing is, death is always the consequence of sin, is always the price of sin. Right? The wages of sin is death, Romans 6:23. See, God will look upon our lives and see the dirty stain of sin, the anger, the hate, the lust, the covetousness, the envy, the idols. The lies that God gave us to worship him, that we then instead turn to worshiping other things. Material objects, or sex, or popularity. See, the wages for our wayward hearts is death. Sin is never to be taken lightly, and the death of this poor innocent lamb is to remind us of the consequences of sin. See, in verse 12, God says he himself will pass through Egypt He's talking about the holy, perfect, just God passing in the midst of sin and sinners. And see, the point here is that Israel are just as guilty as Egypt. Israel are sinners too. Do you get that? See, there's no one righteous, not even one. All have fallen short of the glory of God, Romans chapter 3. Pharaoh hardened his heart against God, and Egypt are judged for their own idolatry, for their injustice and the pain they inflicted through slavery. But Israel are just as guilty. See, the spoiler alert of the second half of Exodus is this. We're going to see, actually, that Israel's hearts are just as hard and just as wayward as Egypt's and of Pharaoh's. How prone to idolatry and distrust they are. See, and that's a message for us too, isn't it? That your heart and my heart are no less prone to being wayward and ignoring God and rebelling at God. We are just as guilty. No one can point to another person and say, well, they're worse and they're more terrible. That's a worse country than our country. Or any of that. Everyone is just as guilty as another. But apart from God's grace, we too are roast. But then the second thing that this little Passover thing is meant to teach them about it is their substitute. You see, the reason for this little innocent lamb and the family is supposed to identify and put in their place is that actually it's this symbol, the symbol that only an innocent, spotless party can take the sin of another. Right? See, no sinner can pay for the sins of another sinner because you've got the sentence of death upon your own head. Only a perfect, spotless sacrifice will do. And so this little lamb that becomes part of your family helps to remind you that actually it has substituted in your place. So I'm just going to get theological for a moment because there's a little shorthand phrase that we often use to kind of describe all of that's going on here, and it helps us describe what Jesus does for us at the cross as well. It's called penal substitutionary atonement. Right, penal meaning penalty, the penalty that's due for our sin. Substitute to remind us that actually someone or something else has actually stepped in and taken that penalty in our place. An atonement, the result that actually we can now be at peace with God, that his judgment is no longer upon us, that we are now can say that we are at one with God. See, the blood on the doorframe, it's just the evidence, it's the sign that actually a sacrifice has been made in that household that has brought atonement. And so God can pass over that household. But then the last symbol that's part of this whole meal is the symbol of their salvation. You see, there's one other element that's supposed to remind them that this is the moment that frees Israel from slavery in Egypt. See, they're meant to eat this meal in readiness, which I think the video did a great job of showing. Verse 11. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. See, this is not a celebration meal. This is not a big feast. We invite everyone over to just go and enjoy the night together. This is the meal the night before the Exodus. The night before you pack up your bags and you flee out of Egypt, the day that your slavery is ended and your freedom has been granted. And so what do? Well, you eat with your cloak, with your sandals on. You're ready to go. You're packed up. You're going to get ready to leave. And see, that's going to be a reminder that even in generations down the track, when they still celebrate the Passover, they are to actually eat like this. This is a quick meal. No time to raise the bread with yeast. No time to kind of cook this lamb slowly over hours and hours. It's a quick meal that you have ready to go the next day. And so it's a reminder, God saved you in that day through the sacrifice of this lamb. And this meal commemorates this moment, signifies it, symbolizes it for Israel now and for the generations to come. See, when God passes over Israel, he visits judgment upon Egypt instead. So verse 12, on that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals. And I'll bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. And so God's judgment passes over the Israelites. Now, I think we often think of being passed over something as actually being a bad thing, right? Like pass over for promotion or, we're not going to do this today, but do you remember the little schoolyard thing when you've got to decide two sports teams and you get a couple of captains up there and they kind of point to other people they want on their team and they take turns. And of course, they always pick the really super sporty people first. And there's always a few people left behind at the end who've effectively been passed over by these captains because they don't actually really want you on their team. They're kind of actually hoping that the other team picks you, but in the end, you're kind of forced to take them. But in a sense, you've been passed over, right? Usually, that's a bad thing. I do remember this one time that was definitely a good thing. I was driving down Kelvin Grove Road when a police car comes up behind me, and the lights start flashing on, and they kind of started motioning for me to pull over. And my mind was racing, and I was thinking through, wait. What did I do? Did I accidentally run a red light? Am I speeding? Did I not realize? So I pulled over to the left and the cop just passes by and then pulls over the ute that was right in front of me. And that kind of moment of pure relief that actually, no, I'm not in trouble. I'm not in trouble at all. Now, the thing is with Israel, they deserve judgment just as much as Egypt, but on the basis of the sacrificial lamb, and of the blood that signified that slaughter, God's judgment passes right over them and onto Egypt instead. See, this monumental day that results in their freedom, it's to be remembered for generations down the generations. It's a sudden moment now, if you read on in Exodus, where it suddenly departs the main narrative and starts talking about the commemorative parts, what you're supposed to do in the future. See, verse 14 says, this is a day you are to commemorate. For the generations to come, you shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. Verse 17, celebrate the festival of unleavened bread, because it was on this very day that I brought your divisions out of Egypt. Celebrate this day as a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. Or read with me the section from verse 24. Come down to verse 24 with me. Obey these instructions as a lasting ordinance for you and your descendants. When you enter the land that the Lord will give you as he promised, observe this ceremony. And when your children ask you, what does this ceremony mean to you? Then tell them, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians. Then the people bowed down and worshipped. The Israelites did just what the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. See, this is a massive moment in the history of Israel. A moment to be remembered for generations and generations down the track. We're sort of not really into tradition that much these days, I find. I think we hate kind of just doing things just because that's the way we've always done things, right? Like we're a bit against tradition. But actually, I think traditions, rituals done right can actually be a good thing for us, right? Connects us. It's often the thing that makes those links from the past to the present, and as we saw in this word to the kids and the generations to come, it forges links to the future as well. See, there's something that happens here that's not just about this moment, but actually it's not just about the passing over of judgment on Israel, but actually there's a defining moment that defines the identity of this nation, of their families, that they would remember and recognize that God saved them. God saved them. By his grace, through the slaughter of an innocent lamb and this Passover, these festivals that they are to celebrate, are meant to remind them of that. Remind them that they won't forget who they are. They won't forget the God that saved them. See, sometimes, it's great that you're here at the Hub because it's hard work, right? It's harder work than just sitting at home and chilling, reading your own Bible, say. But actually, there's something about gathering weekly to meet with others to remind each other of God's salvation. That getting together, pray and read the Bible in growth group takes a lot of effort. But there's something that God has given us and so that we wouldn't forget. That we won't forget the way that God has saved us. In our family as well, there's certain traditions and rituals that we've been trying to create lately to try and help us as a family remember the gospel. This is something that my wife came up with. We've done it for the last couple of years. A set of little eggs that we open at Easter. And there's six eggs, and each of them inside have an element as part of the Easter story. And so our kids now, they know what to expect, they know what's in them, but they kind of still look forward to actually opening these eggs because each time it reminds us of the Easter story. It's something they look forward to. Now, something that we'll probably have to review and change as the kids grow older and things, you need to keep updating those sorts of things. But actually, I'm hoping that as a family, we'll do things together that will keep reminding us of the gospel. This is an epic story, one that needs to be remembered, but ultimately, actually, it's not the ultimate story. In fact, the Passover was actually just a prototype of the true atoning sacrifice that would one day bring redemption to the whole world. See, there's another night in the future, another Passover night, in fact, as 13 Jewish friends got together to celebrate the Passover. And while they were eating, one of them, Jesus, broke the bread and said, "Take this. This is my body." And then he took a cup and gave thanks and said, "This is the blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many." Jesus knew, even there at the Passover, the Last Supper, as we would call it, Jesus knew that he himself was the sacrificial lamb, the ultimate sacrificial lamb. And though daunted by the prospect of bearing the sins of the whole world, he submitted to his Father's will. And on a dark and haunting night, like the night of the original Passover, he was betrayed by Judas, abandoned by his friends, delivered over by corrupt chief priests, and unjustly condemned to death by crucifixion. A spotless, innocent man. His blood wasn't smeared on the doorposts. It was smeared, in fact, on two wooden beams of a Roman cross. And as the Romans and chief priests celebrated, thinking that they had solved their issues by getting rid of the man, God had his own plan, that his son would be the perfect atoning sacrifice for the sins of you and me. Our death substituted with his. Friends, we can be at peace with God today because of what Jesus did for us, that our penalty has been paid.